Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Today we're going to look about the relationship between the print media, the newspaper industry in Nazi Germany, and the Nazi state itself. And we're looking today again at Nazism, a documentary reader by Noakes and Pridham. The Noakes and Pridham series, if you're studying Nazi Germany or teaching it, is simply indispensable as a source of primary evidence and also really, really sharp analysis. Anyway, without further ado, Noakes and Pridham write, "Since the radio was already controlled by the Reich and the states before 1933, its coordination proved relatively easy. The press, which was in the hands of private companies, political parties and religious bodies, was another matter altogether. To ensure the regime control over the press, three main policies were pursued. First, those involved in the newspaper business, publishers and journalists, were subject to strict controls. Secondly, the party's publishing house, Eher Verlag, acquired the ownership, either direct or indirect, of the bulk of the German press. Thirdly, the propaganda ministry maintained a continuous control over the content of the press through the state-controlled press agency via a stream of directives issued at daily German press conferences." So the trilogy of books on Nazi Germany by Richard J. Evans, the second of which, The Third Reich in Power, features a lot of coverage about the nature of the press. And the point that he makes is that most editors and most proprietors of newspapers could see the writing on the wall long before 1933. They were aware of the inevitability of censorship, of totalitarian control, of channels of discourse like the newspapers, and they saw it as ultimately futile to try to fight it. The point that he makes is that newspapers went through a great deal of self-censorship in the knowledge that there was no point in attracting the wrath of the Reich propaganda ministry and the Nazi party in general. Noakes and Pridham write that following the takeover of Germany by the Nazi party, 1933-34, the German Publishers Association, the VDZV, tried to preserve the position of those publishers who tried to seek a kind of a cordial relationship with the state. It actively encouraged and created channels of communication between the state and pliant publishers and editors, so that cordial relationships could flourish and nobody needed to actually be coerced. The members of the VDZV were encouraged to be self-coordinating, and Hitler and senior Nazis made sympathetic noises to those editors and proprietors who behaved in this way. The members of the association whose faces didn't fit, who had politically unpalatable views in the eyes of the Nazis, were removed and replaced with Nazis. And Max Amann, who had been the original publisher of Mein Kampf and who was the head of IHA Verlag, was made chairman of the organisation. Noakes and Pridham write, "On the 30th of April 1933, the Journalists' Association, the Reich Association of the German Press, felt obliged to elect the Nazi press chief, Otto Dietrich, as chairman, and at the same time announced that in future membership of the association would be compulsory for all journalists and that all members would be vetted for racial and political reliability." Of course, it goes without saying that Jewish journalists had very, very bleak career prospects. There was no official law, rather like the laws banning Jews from the civil service and the medical practice. However, it was considered to be political suicide for editors to keep Jewish staff members on. On the 4th of October 1933, the regime changed the position of the newspaper editor, and in particular the relationship between editors and publishers, in a major piece of law which was known as the Editor's Law. The Editor's Law was based on a Journalist's Bill of 1924, which had at the time been rejected, and it was also based on a piece of Italian fascist press legislation. And here are some of the clauses of that piece of legislation. "Participation in the shaping of the intellectual content of the newspapers or political periodicals published within the area of the Reich, whether by written word or by dissemination of news and pictures, and whether carried out as a main employment or based on an appointment to the position of editor-in-chief, is a public task of which the professional duties and rights are regulated by the state through this law." So here was a dramatic extension of the power of the state into the editorial process by saying that this was no longer a private business. This was a public task. What was being said by newspapers was of public concern. Another clause reads, "The Reich Minister for Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda will determine which periodicals are to be considered as political within the meaning of the law. In case the periodical affects a specific vocational field, he will make the decision in consultation with the highest Reich or state agency concerned." So it was Goebbels' role to determine what was to be politicised and what was not. And ultimately, nearly all print media falls under the auspices of being politicised in the end. "Participation in the shaping of the intellectual content of German newspapers is also considered as such, even if it does not take place in the management of a newspaper, but in the establishment which is to supply newspapers with intellectual content, the written word, news or pictures." So this was essentially saying that the creation of news content, the creation of written content, was a political act, just as the role of editor could be seen as a political role and publications could be seen as political entities. Now, the simple act of writing the news, writing it from a particular perspective, choosing particular kinds of news stories to cover, ignoring other kinds of news stories that might not seem newsworthy, these are seen as political acts. "Editors must possess German citizenship, have not lost their civic rights and the qualification for the tenure of public office, are of Aryan descent and not married to a person of non-Aryan descent, have completed their 21st year, are competent at business, have been trained in the profession, have the qualities which the task of exerting intellectual influence on the public requires. And it's always these broad and kind of slightly open catch-all concepts that mean that the Nazis do control absolutely everything in the end. Having qualities which the task of exerting intellectual influence on the public requires. What kinds of qualities? Well, loyalty to Nazi doctrine and the ability to have the judgment bring about any ideas into kind of the public forum that are contrary to Nazi ideas. So the responsibility for editorial content was placed in the hand of the editor. And as long as the editor was willing to abide by the new Nazi control of the newspaper industry, they became largely unsackable. Publishers who owned the newspaper businesses or who acted on behalf of wealthy owners, these individuals tended to lose a great deal of status and power to the editor. The editor was the person who would be making the kinds of day-to-day decisions the Nazis wanted enacted in the print media. The editors perhaps considered themselves to have a greater autonomy very briefly, but the result ultimately was that they lost all of that and simply gained new bureaucratic managers and bureaucratic masters in the guise of the state, as opposed to that of private capital. The law even defined newspaper editors as a state organ who is called upon to fulfil one of the most important tasks of the state. So they were looked upon really as semi-private employees of or workers who worked on behalf of the further needs of the Nazi state. Under the law, the Reich Association established a list of accredited journalists and a system of professional courts to enforce a journalist's code, which also operated on the basis that journalism was a public function. Now, we are used in democratic societies to thinking of journalism as having a public service value, and that, you know, for example, investigative journalism serves the public often at the expense of state malpractice or malfeasance. Here, the terminology is interesting. The blurring of the state and the public is central to Nazi thinking, because the idea was that as the public is, once the Jews and Gypsies and things like that have been got rid of, will be a homogeneously a racial body, a racial organ, then a racial state is the only natural form of government that can represent them. And therefore, a Nazi party is able to exert its power with some kind of moral clarity over things like the newspaper industry and simply tell them, you are now there to serve the public. And by serving the public, the only way you can serve the public is by serving the Nazi party, which is the ultimate expression of the people's will. This kind of naked racial populism. The Reich Minister of Propaganda was appointed president of the association and was given a veto over the admission to the occupational list. So anyone he didn't like the look of didn't get the right to work as a journalist. If you were a journalist, you knew that you could be held to account legally for what you wrote. By 1935, 1,300 Jewish and Marxist journalists had been purged from the profession. The law represented a huge victory for Goebbels and for Dietrich. But the assault on the press had obviously begun significantly before that. I mean, for example, on the 15th of November 1933, Max Amann gained control over German publishing when he was appointed as the president of the Reich Press Chamber.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Which had been established by law relating to the Chamber of Culture of the 22nd of September 1933. Clause 4 of the regulations of the Press Chamber made membership of the Chamber compulsory for all those engaged in publishing. So if you wanted to publish, you needed to be part of the Reich Press Chamber. Under Clause 10, anyone could be excluded from membership who was considered politically unreliable or who lacked suitable qualifications for the profession. While Clause 25 empowered the Reich Chamber to lay down the conditions for opening and closing down businesses and to regulate all important matters concerning the publishing of businesses. So what that meant is journalists could be dismissed for virtually any reason, any time they were deemed to be unsuitable. And also, newspapers could be shut down. And it was these sorts of things that really focused the thoughts of newspaper editors, and also the existence of concentration camps, the knowledge that it didn't necessarily stop there, that one could be arrested and imprisoned. It was these clauses that gave Armin total power over German publishing. His power was largely exercised by his deputy, Rolf Reinhardt, who ran the Publishers Association, which was reorganised later on the 18th of February 1934 as a compulsory membership organisation, and it was directly suborned to the Reich Press Chamber. So the following statistics give you a breakdown of the consequences of all of this. So in 1933, Germany had more daily newspapers than America, and more than the combined total of France, Britain and Italy. The media kind of ecology, the media infrastructure in Germany was so enormously diverse. There were papers for daily national newspapers, regional newspapers, political parties had newspapers, trade unions had newspapers, religious organisations had newspapers. There was a wide, wide variety. Stuttgart alone, with a population of 400,000, had 9 newspapers. Stettin, with 254,000 people, had 5 newspapers. It's one newspaper per 50,000 people. It's quite extraordinary. Most small rural towns had one. Many of these papers were uneconomic and had been badly hit by the Depression. So many were wiped out by the Depression, were closing down as a result. At the end of 1932, the 59 Nazi daily newspapers had a combined circulation of just 782,121, which accounted only for 2.5% of the total. They were largely poorly written, poorly edited, poorly produced, and constantly suffered from financial difficulties. In fact, the only time that Nazi newspapers really make any money is when they become largely compulsory, and they are able to take huge subsidies from the state, and there's all sorts of graft as well, too. when the Nazis seized power and managed to exploit the new situation to strengthen their position at the expense of socialist and communist newspapers, they were able to put socialist and communist publishing houses out of business quite easily by sometimes just burning them down, other times marching in, arresting the staff, giving them a good beating from the brown shirts and saying, this establishment has now changed hands. So simply sort of violence, arson and theft were what wiped out a great deal of the newspapers of the left in Germany. By the end of 1933, the Nazis had acquired, to use the broadest sense of the word, 27 newspapers and increased the total circulation of the Nazi press by 2.4 million copies a day. This process continued during 1934, particularly with regard to the large publishing firm Ullstein that was Jewish-owned, which was seized by the Nazis. Armin and Reinhard were unhappy, by and large, by the lack of party control over German newspaper publishers. And by 1936, when action under Clause 10 of the Press Chamber Regulations had been completed, only about 100 newspaper publishers had been declared ineligible, and large numbers of other middle-class publishers, while outwardly conforming, were clearly by no means National Socialist in spirit. So here is one of the kind of the paradoxes of totalitarianism in Germany, in that there were a large number of organisations that made the right noises, who were not by any means directly oppositional at all, who wouldn't have dared to be that, but they did what they had to do, did as much as they had to do to keep the Nazis off their backs, and continued to some extent in much the ways that they had been writing and publishing. So small newspapers in German towns that were not necessarily anti-Nazi, but they knew that their readership liked a certain kind of journalism and liked the regular kinds of news and features that they come to expect. And many of these newspapers knew that they had to accommodate the Nazis and to write Nazi-friendly kind of stories, but tried ultimately not to be too radically changed, and tried ultimately to give their readership, who would perhaps best be described as local, with kind of parochial interests in the news of their area, and perhaps conservative with a small c, in you know, many people that receive a local newspaper like what they like. And they were trying to walk a tightrope between keeping their readership and appeasing the Nazi state. More prosperous newspaper chains, known as the General Anziger Press, that had little interest in politics and were looking to create wide circulations with a view to boosting advertising revenue. These were the kinds of concerns that really bothered the Nazis, because they created a large number of fairly apolitical newspapers. They toe the line, basically, and try to stay out of trouble. But they were seen by the Nazis as serious competition. Not only were they able to suck in lots and lots of revenue, but their coverage was pretty much a desert for Nazi ideas. The ideal newspaper, as far as Goebbels was concerned, would be packed full of racial and ideological messages from start to finish, and simply having a broadly apolitical and often parochial way of seeing the world was not good enough. So in 1935, Max Amann decided that he would issue three ordinances under Clause 25 of the Reich Press Chamber Regulations. These ordinances said that Ahriman's power to close publishing enterprises where competition created unsound publishing conditions were now in force. They required a detailed disclosure of the ownership of private publishing firms, so the actual beneficial ownership of those firms had to be set out, and our Aryan ancestry needed to be established for all owners, on the assumption that at least there would be at least some Jews or half Jews in there who could be present the likes of Ahriman with a pretext for shutting the newspaper down. Details of any subsidies received had to be disclosed as well. They excluded from future ownership of newspapers all corporate forms of business enterprise and legally registered societies, organisations, or public or private foundations or trustee representatives. So it meant that it was much, much harder for, say, for example, large numbers of shareholders to own a particular newspaper and therefore to object if the Nazis made a move against the editorial content of the newspaper. And they also prohibited newspapers designed to appeal to confessional, vocational or special interest groups. So newspapers for particular trades, newspapers for special interests for minority groups perhaps, or newspapers for religious groupings. So by 1935-36, the clamping down of the newspaper industry was complete. And it should never be overlooked with these things, the more base kind of instincts of the Nazis. And this was a regime based on staggering corruption. And the newspaper industry, then as now, is and a source of immense revenues, and the ability to channel those revenues into the party and into the pockets of individual party members and senior party members was no small part of the motivation here. But of course, Goebbels was fighting his to bring about what he viewed as a total revolution in thought in Germany. The kind of idea that he espoused in 1933, where he believed that there should be no idle bystanders or passive spectators in Nazi Germany, but those who participated fully in Nazi racial ideology. Anyway, I will finish there, and thanks very much for listening. And do always remember, you can find us on Patreon, and we do survive at the Explain History podcast with a tiny trickle of and revenue and the kindness of our patrons. So if you can support us, that would be great. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.